Rutgers and Polk.
No, they're all big.
Down to Olmsted County to
we must be
talk on the. To read that, that's going to be introduced this week.
Have your attention, please. At this time, we will start the Committee on Energy, Utilities, Technology, and Communications. And I see we have about half of our committee here. I would really like everybody to be here. I'm going to ask John Fuller to give us an update on where we are at this present time on the renewable energy objective.
Madam Chair, members, of course, where we are may not be where you are, but we did have a meeting on Friday, and a lot of people showed up and had a healthy discussion. It's pretty clear that, you know, the size of the standard and who's subject to it and what discretion there is with the PUC are some big issues. But if you have the side-by-side, it's not necessary that you do, because I'll just talk. With the renewables that count, you know, it's pretty clear that everybody wanted to go up from 60 to 100. Landfill gas, there was apparently some question whether or not it was in. There seemed to be consensus that that's the sort of renewable that everybody agreed should be in, so that seems to be in. Eliminating the biomass set-aside, there was a trade association that testified against that, seemed like there was some feeling that that would be a good idea to let the market just play out, particularly if the size of the mandate goes up. There will be plenty of opportunities for biomass facilities to enter into the market. The size of the proposal was somewhat off the table. As you recall, the two leading numbers are either 20 by 20 or, which is Senate File 4, 25 by 25, and then Senator Solon had a wait-and-see attitude in her bill. I think one thing you might want to think about, apart just from the absolute numbers, is the ramping up of those numbers. You know, the current law says you have to go 1% a year, which made it difficult to do large projects. And so some thought maybe you want to think about whether the ramping, I see in Senate File 4 is 11 by 2013, 15 by 2015, and 25 by 2020. I think there is some interest in flexibility with respect to the track to the total. The label to describe the obligation, I think the general sense was that the label was not that significant. It's the underlying operative language, as we talked about before. No resolution was made on that issue, but I don't think it's a major sticking point, although it's not, there's not an agreement. How the PUC modifies standard or objective, it's clear that that's tied into what electric utilities are subject to the law, because the standard or objective is a one-size-fits-all. So what you would find commonly in our discussions on Friday was different segments of the utility industry saying, we're differentially situated with respect to our need and our ability to comply with whatever the target is. And that's factually the case. So there are negotiations going on now. As you know, under current law, in many aspects, the Xcel Energy Company, known as the public utility that operates the nuclear facility, has a different set of requirements. And they did come in and testify that they're willing to have a different set of requirements. They'd like to have some flexibility in what's counted. And so that's an ongoing process. That has some other items connected to it, perhaps. And there is no agreement on that, but I would say the discussions are serious. But there's no agreement on how differentially Xcel would be treated. There's no discussion so far with respect to treating any other segment of the utility industry differentially, except if you go back to the notion of the discretion, the flexibility, the ability of the PUC to administer the law in a fashion that intelligently achieves the goals while considering the issues of reliability, costs, and technical feasibility, that's where those issues crop up then, because the individual utilities say, well, for us, our segment, this is what we need. So that's where it rears its head again. And on that front, there has been back-and-forth progress, I would say. It seems like there's an understanding. They refer to these as off-ramps. So everybody, you know, the on-ramp is for everybody, is the terminology. Everybody starts out, they have to do the same thing. And so they're saying, well, gee, not only because of circumstances that are unknown in the future, but because of the situation we, as a particular utility, are in, we need to be able to get off that. It can be delayed or modified. And so there are different proposals in each bill. They're working on that. I think that they'll bear fruit. I mean, I think the general notion, there was a statement of intent passed out, I think people basically agreed with, which was something like this. The overriding goal is to achieve the preference is for renewable energy, and the goal is to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. However, we realize that the road to that, you need some flexibility in those who administer it. And we're concerned about cost and technical innovations coming along, reliability. However, just some cost or some reliability issues or some concerns about technical ability will not be sufficient. It requires some higher level for the commission to decide that the public interest would require a modification of the standard, either a delay or speeding it up or reducing it or increasing it. And the utilities do not like the notion of increasing it. It makes it hard for them to plan. All right. And then with respect to the compliance, I'd say there was an agreement that the PUC should be given authority to do more oversight, that they should have the authority to issue orders for compliance. With respect to penalties, they have the authority to issue penalties, and there was some concern about where they would go. But intellectually, if you think that the penalty equals the cost of compliance, it would be surprising if there ever was a penalty issued, because if the penalty is equal to the cost of either buying the credits or building the facilities, it's hard to imagine an entity that wouldn't ultimately comply rather than foregoing their money. So I think that's evolved into a non-issue as far as that. Of course, the weighting scale of renewables, everybody wanted to get rid of that. The tradable credits is where the most progress was made. The regulators and the stakeholders sat down, and I believe now there's agreement that we should require the PUC to have a program. It seems like it'll happen by January of 2008, and then the PUC has the ability to issue orders for people to join maybe MRETs and to establish protocols for the system, and it would be the trading of credits that reflect energy that would count under our law, not renewable energy that they couldn't go out and buy something that was ineligible in our law in another state and then get credit for it. So the reach of the law, it would be the credits can only represent energy that we find acceptable under the renewable energy law. One other issue, the issue of on-ramps and off-ramps raises another issue, which is if you want to give the Utilities Commission flexibility, at what cost, so to speak? If every year a utility has to come in and hire a raft of lawyers or be uncertain, you know, how do you plan into the future? So I think some thought should be given to if there's a way to minimize the regulatory burdens from requesting a modification of delay if it's pretty obvious it should be granted, while still maintaining the right of the public to say, hey, wait a minute, get their due process. So we haven't really gone down that avenue too much, but I think it's a legitimate objection by those subject to the standard that to gain the flexibility, they'll have to expend more money than it seems worth. So I think we should give some thought. If we are going to give flexibility, let's not make it too expensive to buy while still maintaining the ability of the public to speak up and make sure the law is being complied with. That's sort of where we're at. Finally, there's been sent to me, because of my role working for the committee, any number of people who have other ideas. And I haven't even had a chance sort of to study those. And I think, Madam Chair, I think the philosophy we're operating on is we're trying, the goal is to keep this pretty focused on 216B.1691. And even if it's somewhat closely related, to try to deal with it in other bills, because just reading over the delete everything amendment today, which is 4 or 5 pages, which is not a delete everything amendment. It's where they were at, but it was in that form. I found 6 technical mistakes that were significant. And it's just you have to be really careful with the terminology because this is going to be litigated a lot. There's people with deep financial interests in this. So I think that's a correct statement. That's sort of the goal, is to segregate out this issue as much as possible so that the committee has the opportunity to get in depth into the nuances of it.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Fuller. I appreciate that overview of the process. And I would also like to reiterate that we will be dealing with the statute that is before us and the revisions to that statute. And so anything else that has to do with renewable energy, I would prefer that it come to us in a separate bill. And let's see, last time we met, we heard or presented 4 bills, and now is the time that we will be taking testimony from the public on the 4 bills that were presented. And the first person I'd like to call upon is Wayne Brandt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Wayne Brandt. I'm the Executive Vice President of Minnesota Forest Industries. Minnesota Forest Industries members are primary manufacturers of forest products, pulp and paper mills, engineered wood products manufacturers, and several of the larger sawmills here in the state. I'm pleased to share with you a few things here today. First, we think that our industry has been the leader in the development of renewable power, particularly electricity here in the state. I believe in your packets you have a handout from us that delineates some of these statistics. With our power generating partners at our facilities, Minnesota Power and the co-op system, we generate about 28% of all of the electricity that we use, generate that from renewable sources. 4% of that is hydroelectric power from dams that have been at paper mills for generations since those mills' inceptions. And 24% comes from biomass. That biomass that we use to generate power is all organic material that comes from the trees that we use to manufacture products. Includes about 1.2 million tons on an annual basis of bark and other residue from the processing of trees. It includes additional organic material from trees as a part of the pulping process, commonly known in the industry as black liquor. I'd kind of hoped to get through this whole issue without ever using the words black liquor, but was brought up last week. I can tell you black liquor is not amaretto, it's not Kahlua, it's something else. What black liquor is, just so you understand, because that ends up being one of the fuels that we use to generate electricity, is it's material that comes out of the pulping process. It includes lignin, which is the compound inside of trees that binds the cellulose, the wood fibers, together. It also is hemicellulose, which is the type of cellulose that more readily dissolves in water in the pulping process, and it includes some cellulose, although we try and keep the cellulose to make into paper. The balance of the material in black liquor is sodium salts that are used in the pulping process that are fully recovered and reprocessed and reused. So those are recovered in the process, and the organic material is then burned to generate electricity. We have invested, along with our partners, over $500 million in the cogeneration from renewable capacity that is currently operating in our industry. That number and these figures do not include turbines and such that we've used in past years and past decades that have come offline. That's just what's been invested in what's currently operating. There obviously are significant ongoing investments in this generating capacity to keep the turbines up to snuff and to keep them running efficiently. We do use additional biomass for other than electricity in our processes. That is primarily wood waste also. We use that to produce process steam that is used in the manufacturing process, as well as heat to use in the manufacturing process to dry lumber and in dry kilns and things of that nature. That fuel source, that biomass, directly replaces natural gas or fuel oil that would otherwise be used. Our request to the committee and to the legislature is really quite simple. We would ask that any legislation that is passed recognize the accomplishments for industries that are out there for generating renewable power, and that the PUC be directed not to charge industries like ours that are already meeting the objectives for renewable power that you seek for developing further renewable power. We kind of feel like we've led the way. We have this material. We've utilized it for many years, and you know, we kind of think that we've paid once and wouldn't want to pay again. So if there's any questions, I'd be happy to respond to them.
Any questions? Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Brandt, when you made the decision, I think it's great that you're doing so much self-generation, and I think a lot of other industries. We just heard a presentation in our last committee about the ethanol industry and how we need to encourage more of them, more of those plants, to self-generate their power source. And they have the ability to do that with the products that they are dealing with on a daily basis. So I think it's great that you're doing this. When you've made this decision to invest in these cogeneration systems for your plant, is this something that you believe is cost effective over the long run, or is it is it more expensive than the natural gas and fuel oil?
Mr. Brandt?
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, I'd like to tell you that we did it for altruistic reasons, but that wouldn't be a correct statement. We did it because it makes business sense for us. We have the organic material, the wood fiber. We're already purchasing it to make products out of. If you look back generations in the industry, 30, 40 years, frequently at sawmills, you would see what were known in the industry at the time as teepee burners, big open-air fires, where they would just take this material. You still see them at some sawmills up in Canada and some other manufacturing plants. They just take the wood waste, and they'd burn it, and up into the atmosphere it would go, just raw open fires. That was all changed at sawmills. That material goes into powering the heat for the dry kilns to dry the lumber. I think as many of you know, our industry invested very heavily in the 80s and 90s in this state. Some $5 billion was invested. And, you know, we looked at this material as an important resource and one that we could capture and that would make cost-effective power for us. I mean, we've already paid for the material coming in. Past generations didn't as efficiently utilize it as we do now.
Madam Chair,
Senator,
I guess,
Senator Anderson.
You know, Mr. Brandt, it's interesting that you explain it that way, because that's exactly how I would, not exactly, but similar to how I would explain this requirement for the utilities, that I think it would make good business sense for them to do this. And I guess I'm not convinced that you buying electricity from some of these utilities that have a higher renewable requirement is going to increase your costs at all.
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, if it's not going to increase our costs at all, then any language that was put in to preclude us from being charged for higher costs would just be occupying space in the statute book.
Well, Madam Chair, Mr. Brandt, that would be
Senator
a hedge
Anderson.
That everybody would love, but I guess we don't all have that option. But I think it's a good gamble, but I hope I'm right.
Mr. Brandt, though, maybe you could comment a little bit more on why an increase in cost is something that you're very concerned about right now.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think, you know, for most people realize that our industry has been facing some difficult economic times, import pressures and various grades of paper, and some significant plant shutdowns here in Minnesota, three oriented strand board plants that have been shut down since September of last year, putting hundreds of people out of work. a parallel strand lumber plant that's operating in Deerwood at half capacity, just laid off another 25 people last week as they cut from 5 days a week to 3.5 days a week. So all of the cost areas are extremely important to us. Costs of fiber, costs of power, all of the things. As we have analyzed the cost structures for the industry here in Minnesota and compared them to our competitors in North America and the world and worldwide, not just comparing to, you know, Mississippi or to third world countries, but comparing us to Scandinavia, to Maine, to Washington, Oregon, there are only two areas that we have an advantage as an industry over our competitors. One is the productivity of our employees, which is a testament to the educational system of our state and the investments in that, and to the capital that's been invested to have productive facilities. And the other area is electricity costs. We have a competitive advantage over most of our competitors on our cost of power. We cannot go backwards on the various things and have a healthy forest products industry here in Minnesota. We need to improve our cost structures. We, as an industry, consume about 15% of the power that Minnesota Power generates. So energy costs are an extremely important issue to us, and that's one of the many reasons why we've invested heavily in utilizing this material to generate electricity.
And I think one of the issues that we need to highlight also is that we're anticipating that there will be a new industry in Minnesota and that we will create a number of jobs. But we also have to be cautious about some of the jobs we may be hindering in the process and whether there might not be some retrenchment in other areas. Senator Vanderveer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Brandt, I might have missed this. I came in a little bit late, but could you just tell me approximately how many people in Minnesota are employed in your industry and maybe tell us where most of those jobs are located?
Madam Chair, Senator Vanderveer, overall there's a little over 40,000 people in the combined forest products industry. They aren't all my members. Lord knows I wish they were. Bigger staff and all that. Of those jobs, both primary and secondary manufacturing, a little over half of those are located in the seven-county metropolitan area.
Okay, thank you. Senator Anderson.
Madam Chair, I hesitate to bring this up, but I'm wondering, isn't Minnesota Power being asked by the proposed Excelsior coal plant to buy their power? And are you weighing in on that as well? Are you concerned about the cost of that?
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, we're concerned about the cost of every electron that comes to our facilities.
Thank you. Mr. Brand, I really would encourage you to work with somebody about putting a bill together, if you would like to have it heard.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I think that's it. Mike Franklin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senators. Thank you for the opportunity to offer some brief comments on some of the legislation before you. My name is Mike Franklin. I'm the Director of Energy Policy for the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Our 2,400 member companies are our ratepayers, and our chief concerns have been and will be, number one, reliability, and number two, competitively priced electricity. You've heard me already testify on the impacts of some of the policy decisions on customers, and you've also heard nearly everyone else who's occupied this chair testify to the need to focus our efforts on making sure that whatever bill you pass is very flexible. And you heard Mr. Brandt just now sort of testify to the reasons why we're concerned as employers. If you had a chance to read the Star Tribune this morning, the article on corn prices and the dynamic of ethanol, I thought that was an interesting article to read today in light of, I knew I'd be sitting in front of you, just the sort of some of the unintended consequences that go along with energy policy and with mandates in particular, and that the effect that can have on other parts of the economy is significant. And it may be an interesting analogy to look at in light of our discussion, your discussion on electricity policy. You know, we all agree that more renewable electricity, more Minnesota-generated power is a good thing, and we want to help be a partner in getting that done. But we believe that it shouldn't translate into supporting a mandate which removes flexibility that we've all sort of also testified is so important and might otherwise prevent the cost of for instance, wind, might protect it from costly fluctuation due to supply shortages or fluctuation in the yearly wind levels or demand spikes on the utility system or even from filling that need with less expensive alternatives that might be available in the future. The three things that we'd ask the committee to remember as you begin your discussion are that competitively priced electricity relative to other states and relative to the global economy is of utmost importance to employers. That flexibility to the Public Utilities Commission with the sort of written presumption of the best deal for the customer, the best bang for the buck, is critical, and that the most cost-effective approach to generating 20 or 25% of renewable electricity by whatever year is we think we can achieve all of those things at the same time. In short and in conclusion, we support a best-of-both-worlds approach. You've heard me testify to, we think, what the wisdom of the good faith effort requirement is under the current law. We think that we can increase that to 25% or to 20%, and you'll all hear testimony as to which number might work best, but we think we can increase it under the current structure. And that way we do experience all of the good economic and environmental benefits that we agree are important to our state and to employers, but also protecting customers and our member ratepayers against unintended consequences. And with that, I'm happy to entertain any questions that you might have.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I can't help but mention another article I read in the paper this morning, and that was the CEO of Xcel saying that joining a lot of national CEOs in calling for a cap on CO2 emissions. And I wonder if you would have some of the same concerns to your members who have to pay for electricity in terms of their rates when if we were talking about building new coal plants, new pulverized coal plants.
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, I think if you look at our record in the Public Utilities Commission over the past few years and have the opportunity to ask anybody from Xcel about our intervention in the rate case last year, I think you'll find the answer is yes.
Thank you.
Other questions or comments? Thank you, Mr. Franklin.
Thank you.
Lauren Logtug.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Lauren Lotog, and I am representing Otter Tail Power Company here today. Just for those of the committee who don't know us very well, we're a small investor-owned utility that serves western and northwestern Minnesota, and we serve about 150 small towns and communities in those areas. The first thing I'd like to say is yes, Minnesota is going to have more renewables, and yes, Otter Tail Power will engage itself more heavily in the wind business. In fact, we own in Fargo, North Dakota, we own a small wind tower manufacturing company, and that little company just barely made it through the year that the federal government cut off the federal production tax credit. But now that it's been extended until December 31st of 2008, DMI Industries is doing very well, and so we look forward to doing a lot more wind business. Every 2 years, the utilities have to file something with the Public Utilities Commission called the Integrated Resource Plan. And just to give you a summary of what our Integrated Resource Plan does, each company runs its own models, and it calculates how much of baseload energy you need, how much midload, how much peaking power you need. And our integrated resource plan, looking out through about 2012, when Big Stone 2 coal plant is supposed to come online, picks 115 megawatts, which is our share of the Big Stone 2 power plant, but it also picks up to 160 megawatts of wind. And I'll point out to you that it does so on an economic basis. And it includes the federal production tax credit, but it's clear that wind has become very economic. And so we will do a lot more wind. In fact, if you look at those two numbers, 115 megawatts of baseload coal versus 160 megawatts of wind, our commitment to wind, if we build as much as 160, our commitment will be almost 40% greater than our commitment to coal. The concerns that we have specifically with the bills that are before us are several. First is the time horizon. A year ago, we were talking about 20% by 2020. The governor has suggested 25 by 25. Those seem to lie along the same trajectory, if you can think of it in terms of a line. And we're confident we can work with 20 by 2020, 25 by 25, whichever number the committee chooses. But we are concerned about compressing that five more years from 2025 back to 2020. And our concerns are similar to Mr. Franklin's. Compressing things five more years can affect equipment prices, for example. A little over a year ago, we discovered that turbine prices had almost doubled because of a shortage of turbines in the market. Now, that was somewhat short-term, but those kinds of things do occur. And we're concerned that if we do compress the time, that we might be pressing ourselves into a corner with more of those kinds of equipment shortages. The labor to build all the transmission that's going to be necessary to do a 20 or 25% commitment to wind. The CapEx folks were here and talked to the committee about transmission commitments. The first phase of CapEx's plan calls for about 600 miles of new transmission lines. To build this out to include a 25% renewable standard, which is what we're talking about, probably means around 1,800 miles of new transmission lines. This is going to take a lot of money and a lot of time to build. And five more years, that is between 2020 and 2025, can be very valuable for accomplishing that. Just Otter Tail Power's share of the first phase of CapEx is about $70 million, and that's a considerable cost for our ratepayers, and that does not include our share of the other 1,200 additional miles that would be necessary to meet the requirements for the renewable energy standard. Off-ramps with respect to, we call them flexibility options. We're concerned about what could happen to price. We need to make sure the commission's got the authority to make adjustments based on price. With respect to reliability, customers like voltage stability. A lot of large business customers require voltage stability to stay in business every day. And if renewables have, for some reason, a negative effect on the transmission system, then we need to make sure that the commission has the flexibility to adjust for that. Regulatory barriers, no fault of our own, the utilities have difficulties in getting approval of transmission certificates of need. The commission should be able to make adjustments for that. And for just general transmission access. These concerns are expressed very clearly in Senator Tomasoni's bill that was discussed here last week. So with that, those are our concerns. We will do what we can. We will do everything we need to reach 25% if that's the committee's wish. We are concerned about the year. I'll take any questions someone might have. Thank you.
Questions or comments? Senator Alcine.
Madam Chair, one of the concerns we heard from CapEx, at least what I was hearing, was that there's a problem with the transmission lines in general, that at some point or other, a lot of these need to be upgraded. So I'm trying to figure out how many of these lines would have been on some kind of a schedule to be upgraded anyhow. Do you have any idea of what those number of miles might be?
Madam Chair and Senator Alcine, the CapEx projections, as I recall them best, are for a total of 6,500 megawatts of new capacity. Of that 6,500, a little over 3,000 is my recollection of renewables. Now, That was prior to the discussion about a 25% renewable standard. That number for conventional energy probably doesn't go up very much, but it goes up substantially. The number that we're using now for renewables is between 6,000 and 7,000 megawatts for renewables. So the requirements for renewables will be more than the requirements for everything else that CapEx was planning.
Thanks. Okay, thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
I'd like to call now on Reverend Mark Peters. He's not here, apparently. Okay. Lisa Daniels.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Lisa Daniels. I'm Executive Director of Windustry. Windustry is a nonprofit organization that has been working since 1995 to increase wind energy opportunities for rural landowners and communities in Minnesota and other states. Windustry seeks to ensure that community wind energy projects have access to transmission facilities and to markets for energy demand. Windustry also provides outreach, education, and pragmatic technical assistance to increase the likelihood of success in developing community wind. Windustry is speaking today in support of SF4, Senator Ellen Anderson's proposal to require that 25% of Minnesota's electricity be generated from renewable energy by the year 2020. From the perspective of the community wind, this renewable energy standard legislation is essential to create the market for community wind. We support it as a necessary first step. Wind energy is the fastest-growing energy sector in the world. That growth resulted from technological innovation and government policies that reflect support for renewable energy. The pace of growth has been the greatest in Europe, where 55% of the new capacity will be installed this year alone. According to the American Wind Energy Association, California is still the state with the most wind power installed, but Texas is gaining fast, with more installed in 2006 and more proposed for 2007. Iowa is in third place, and Minnesota is struggling to hold on to fourth place right now, with Colorado right behind us. Enacting a renewable energy standard strengthens the market by internalizing many benefits of wind energy that are outside the current cost structure, including benefits of carbon neutrality and energy independence. This policy is critical to establish a market for community wind. However, as both Chair Yvonne Pretner Solon and Senator Ellen Anderson have recognized, a renewable energy standard alone is insufficient to unleash the potential for community wind. Local communities and local investors face significant barriers to entry into the market to provide electricity. These barriers range from access to development capital, access to transmission, access to energy expertise, and last but not least, access to high-quality wind turbines. Windustry is working together with community-based energy developers, local government representatives, financial experts, and farm representatives to develop proposals that will provide transmission access, interconnection, and critical financial tools for community wind. We look forward to working closely with this committee and committees in the House and Department of Commerce to establish leadership to develop a separate companion piece of legislation focused on community energy. Once the playing field is opened up, Windustry believes that community energy will be able to reach its full potential, providing jobs, investments, and cost-efficient renewable energy throughout Minnesota. Thank you for your support of the Renewable Energy Standard and for your commitment to work together on a separate bill to provide further needed support for community energy.
Thank you. Comments or questions? Thank you, Ms. Daniels. Greg Oxley.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Greg Oxley. I represent the Minnesota Municipal Utilities Association. I've been before the committee a couple of times, so I won't explain the organization again. It occurred to us when we were talking about this bill recently as a group at MMUA that in 10 years' time, we can either be very proud of the product we've produced or we can be horrified by the unintended consequences and madly scrambling to fix it. From the beginning, when we started to consider this issue last August in my organization, it was our intent to provide what we thought was Minnesota's safe step-by-step progression into the widespread use of renewable energy. And that's the premise for the Tomasoni bill. We don't disagree with what Senator Anderson is trying to do. In fact, we like some of the off-ramps that she has proposed. We may not want to go quite that as far as she does, but we are in favor of renewable energy. We're simply trying to find the best way to make it happen. When I was representing the cooperatives years ago, I was told at every National Association of Regulatory Utility Commissioner meeting I went to from 1995 to 1999 how great California was doing in bringing about competition on the retail level. Their legislation, if you remember, talked about aspirations, but it didn't cover the details on the ground. It turned out in 2000 to be the biggest self-induced electric utility disaster in American history, and it has killed retail competition on the retail level. We don't want that to happen with renewables. We want it to work. In fact, we feel we need renewables in our future, and that is the purpose of the Tomasoni bill. First, we want to give more consideration, and we hope the committee will give consideration, as my colleague from Otter Tail Power pointed out, to the impact of transmission on this whole issue. It is the 800-pound gorilla in this thing and is going to continue to be. It is going to affect timing. It is going to affect cost. It is going to affect everything that we do, our ability to come to certain levels. Second, the permit approval process could also be a real problem. I was a part of an organization that was trying to put in a 345 kV AC line, a big line from Dickinson to Wilmer 25 years ago, and the project died because we couldn't get the approval and because the cost went from $11 million to $44 million. It was a mess, and I was part of the DC line as well, and I can tell you that putting in transmission is not easy. It is not easy at all. It is not a sure thing. Third, the equipment we'll need may or may not be available. Right now, we're waiting 3 years for turbines. We are hopeful that the turbine industry will accelerate, and I believe it will. But for a while, and we don't know how long, there's going to be limits here. And we think that that should be in the mix and something considered in the law. That's considered in the Tomasoni bill. Fourth, this legislation should represent a goal, not a range. As was mentioned by John Fuller before, we are very concerned about being told when we get to the end of what we thought was the goal we were trying to reach, that because others couldn't reach their goal, we're going to have to go higher than what the law would require or accelerate our activities faster than what the law calls for. We don't believe that that kind of uncertainty is wise, and we hope that the committee will not engage in that. We have picked 20% by 2020 as something that we can reasonably hope to make, and that's why we went for that particular percentage. We didn't do a lot of study, any more study than anyone else, but we know something about the industry that we're involved with, and because of the transmission problem, that appears to be the upper edge of what the industry can make at that time. We believe in the off-ramps that Senator Anderson has put in SF4 about reliability, rate increase, and technical difficulties, but we also believe that consideration of transmission, the availability of equipment, and the ability to get permitting is an important consideration that should be put in the bill as well. We believe that the Public Utilities Commission should have flexibility, but we have seen through hard example what a mess can be made in front of the commission if we don't have clarity and clear direction, and that's the reason for the off-ramps. We have a couple of other things in the bill. I think we can wait on those. We certainly agree with this business of dealing with the credits, and we appreciate that being put into the bill. We're concerned about green pricing staying because that was supposed to be something that was to stimulate our participation, and now we can't count it towards our goal. With that said, I am prepared to answer any questions that many might have right now.
Senator Jungbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm not sure if Mr. Oxley can answer this, but as we're going through this whole process, I'm kind of assuming some of the other committee members have the same thought process I have, is, you know, I'm kind of picking out the pieces of the bill I like, the pieces of the bill I may or may not like, but mostly I'm having a hard time coming up with a decision on how do we implement this based on nobody has told us what does it take from time of permit application to getting a permit, and even if you could expedite that process to put up a new transmission line. So what I really need to know, at least to make my mind up, is what's the time frame for a permit, and what's the actual time frame, assuming everything is perfect, to get the first, let's say, 600-mile, 345 kVA line up. Those are real key factors in I think, the whole way we look at this bill.
Over the years, Senator, excuse me.
Yes, Mr.
Madam Chair. Senator Jungbauer, I've been told over the years that the permitting is supposed to be a year, and that's the statutory limit, but it goes beyond a year on some occasions. That is one of the concerns that we had in the other part of the bill, and we'll address in other legislation. We believe that that should be a deadline, and anyone who's spent time in the Minnesota State Legislature knows that nothing would ever get done without a deadline. We want to have the upper edge of what we're going to have to take. Right now we have several of our members have a line before the Public Utilities Commission whose certificate of need should have been made, a decision should have been made in November. Now it's not going to be made until May, and it costs $1 million per month for each month of delay. That's a lot of money. For the plant that is connected to, it's $7 million for each month of delay. So the permitting process is important and can be a problem. As I told you, we lost a project from Dickinson to Wilmarth, a very large line, simply because the agency told us they didn't know when they were going to make a decision, and the cost had already gone from $11 million to $44 million. This permitting process is essential. Also, it takes time beyond that for us to plan for it, because we got to get involved with the serpentine Byzantine world of the transmission utility engineer. And I know from 30 years of experience, I don't know what they do, but I know I must listen to them, or it's a disaster if I don't.
Senator Jungbauer, I don't know if you have further questions of Mr. Oxley, but Janet Gonzalez is here from the PUC and may be able to answer your question also.
Well, Madam Chair, I was just going to say, if Mr. Oxley, the other issue was the amount of time to build that transmission line, so I don't mind if Mr. Oxley can't answer that, but I'm hoping that as people come before us to address some of these things, they fill in those kind of gaps that we really need to make this decision. So I'm kind of making that blanket statement so that we can get those details. We hear a lot of passion on both sides about what we might want, and one end and the other, but we kind of need some hardcore facts here to really move towards our decision making.
Madam Chair,
Mr. Oxley,
the biggest utility planning project in Minnesota history is going on right now, called the CapEx 2020 project. That doesn't include all of the requirements that we're seeing in this bill. We have to also remember that the other expedient here is the fact that the electric utility industry and its transmission system is now being asked to do things in the wholesale level for competition that the system was never designed to do. That's the other variable that we have to think about in this. It is a long, time-consuming, expensive process. It takes a lot of money. It takes a lot of engineers, and we're not sure that we can get it done in the accelerated time frame that we're looking at.
Madam Chair?
Okay. Yes, Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question then, if the time frame you're talking about, if you can make 20 by 2020, can you also make 25 by 2025?
We have talked about that internally, and as you might imagine, with 126 members, it's difficult to get everybody together to turn that boat. But I believe that that's in the same projection, and I believe that my membership, especially the Joint Action Agency, feels that's possible.
Senator Olsen.
Sir, you said something that almost knocked me out of my chair, and it's you said nothing ever gets done without a deadline when you were talking about the legislature.
That's right.
And that kind of said it all right there for me, because I think the idea of the carrot in the, you know, kind of the carrot approach, I think that, well, I guess that's kind of where I'm coming from, is that I believe that by putting a standard in, that the industry will raise to that. When the interstate system was built, I suspect they were saying, where will we get all the rebar? Where will we find all the concrete? Yet here we have this interstate system that's now falling apart, but was built in probably pretty record time. I suspect that could happen with the power lines.
Do you Madam wish Chair? To comment, Mr. Oxley?
You bet. We agree, and that's why we went to 2020. But the deadline has to be based on a standard that we feel we can meet. This is a lot like tailoring a suit in reverse. You can always let it out, but you can't take it in, or not easily take it in politically, once you've put a stake in the sand. We don't want to be in a position in 5 years' time where we're scrambling madly to change things because we did not plan for the safe, step-by-step progression into the widespread use of renewables. We want to do it. We want to have a deadline, and we want to do it right. That's the reason that we've set 20% by 2020. And as for these off-ramps that we think are extremely important for the future of the industry and to get this thing done the right way, so we'll be proud of what we've done in 10 years and not scrambling to try and change it.
Okay, I'm going to call on Janet Gonzalez now. I'm going to ask Mr. Fuller to frame the question.
Good afternoon. You want to identify yourself first?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Janet Gonzalez. I'm the Energy Unit Manager for the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission.
Mr. Fuller.
Following up on Senator Jungbauer's question, it's my understanding that in the past number of years, 5 or 6 years, there was a major transmission project that was proposed in southwestern Minnesota to bring power up the Buffalo Ridge. Could you explain the time frames of that project and what's happened?
Ms. Gonzalez.
Madam Chair, Senator Jungbauer, and other members of the committee, I didn't really come prepared with knowing the exact timeline on that. At the time that was proposed, that first of all, I should remember, I believe that's 3 or 4 separate projects that were all separate lines that were all put together into one certificate of need filing. So it covered a large part. It had a lot of different parts to it. And just also be aware that at that time, the certificate of need process was separate from the siting and routing process, which was at the EQB, the Environmental Quality Board. At the commission, I can't tell you exactly how long it took. It may have taken longer than 12 months, but I don't think it took significantly longer. There were a lot of people who intervened in that case. There were a number of issues that had to be developed to try to assure to the extent possible that that line could be used for wind. MISO came on the scene in the middle of that. Really, that proceeding in many ways was the beginning, at least from the commission's perspective, of seabed kind of came out of that proceeding. So many things came out of that. It may have taken somewhat longer than 12 months, but not a lot. I would also state that the routing permits, which is also required, once the need is established, then you need to know exactly where does it go. The need sort of says you need something from point A to point B. The routing says how do you get from point A to point B, or maybe have to go to point A to C, but exactly where do you go? That tends to get, you know, people whose land is actually going to be affected are obviously concerned with that, even if it's for a beneficial project. The utility Xcel did do those things separately and later after they got the certificate of need. So all in all, the whole process has taken some time, but that's partly the utility's choice and partly just how the structure was done. You'll remember that in the 2005 legislation, the commission now has authority over siting and routing as well as certificate of need. To the extent feasible, we have been trying to combine those processes. That may take a little more time for certain processes, but in aggregate, it should save quite a bit of time most of the time. However, I have to be honest about this. A controversial proceeding such as Big Stone, which is what's being referred to, veiledly referred to there by Mr. Oxley and his clients, a controversial proceeding is going to take time. There are due process requirements. The due process sometimes goes up against that year. A very controversial project is probably not going to get done in a year when it's both certificate of need and routing. It's going to get done substantially sooner than it would have under separate processes, and it's going to get done in a way that will stand up in court when the process is over, which I think the utilities should be particularly appreciative of. You do not want to have a process that says that your only goal is to get it done in 11 months and 59 days and have it thrown out of court because of procedural technicalities or not such technicalities. You have to allow people who are interested in the procedures to intervene. Some processes are just going to take a certain amount of time. We have been extremely diligent in trying to implement your 2005 directions to try to make the processes go as smoothly as possible. But other than prohibiting certain types of people from intervening or something, there's not a whole lot you can do to make them go extremely quickly. We've done the best we can. We send them generally to the Office of Administrative Hearings, who are very good at running hearings. It's very important also that the filings that people make are good and complete to begin with, so you have adequate information and the parties have that. And, you know, we've most of the proceedings the commission has had on projects have been within the timelines. Very controversial projects are going to take longer. I think it would be very hard to – I'm not quite sure how you'd legislate against that. There's a due process requirement in many parts of the statute. You don't want your constituents calling you up and saying they're putting this thing in my backyard and never talk to me. It's just a very difficult balancing. I think we've done as good a job as we can. If I could take this time also
Ms. Gonzalez, yes. I'd like to ask you a question first. When you refer to 11 or 12-month period, and are you referring to the permitting period? Are you referring to acquiring the land, the building of the transmission?
No, Madam Chair, I'm speaking just about the regulatory process right now. The statute gives a guideline that the commission is to complete a certificate of need in 1 year. It also contemplates that in most cases that the route for a transmission line, that the routing process would be done in 1 year. That's just the time from the utility filing for permission with the commission to say it's needed or to route it to having the commission come out with an order. That does not include any building time. It also does not include time that people might ask for the commission to reconsider the decision or to send it to or to appeal it to court.
Okay, thank you.
If I could I make just one more statement that in response to what Mr. Oxley has said earlier, I would note that the commission's certainly fine with having having a requirement to do renewable energy credits as opposed to just permissive. I would like to point out that the statute did not give the commission that authority to do anything. That was in 2001, as has been alleged. That was in the put in the statute in 2003, became effective in July. We have been working diligently since then. We think it's much more important to get the rules set, who's define the types of facilities that qualify. You can't have a trading program till you know what's traded and what things qualify. We had procedures to do that. We also had no money to pay consultants or to do anything else to come up with this. We've gotten Joyce Foundation grants through the help of a number of organizations who've helped us along with this. We are well on our way to do it. We don't have an objection to having a deadline. I just wanted to set the record straight on the length of time that this has taken. It's not taken nearly that much time, and it is also very important that everything else get in place. I would think the committee would be much more interested in actually having facilities in place than credits are sort of an adjunct and something that could be helpful, but certainly are not the primary focus of what this renewable energy objective is, at least in staff's eyes. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Sharon.
Thank you, Chair. I'm wondering, Ms. Gonzalez, one of the things that I think that I've heard in the course of these presentations is that one of the problems with the permitting process is that for some reason they're long and cumbersome, and that as a result of the permitting process that we have here, we've lost opportunities for the development of facilities from this state to other states and the jobs and the economic advantages that have come from that. Can you tell me what the difference is between our permitting process and another state's permitting process that makes it more attractive for someone to go to another state rather than stay in Minnesota?
Ms. Gonzalez?
Madam Chair, Senator, first of all, there may be some other instances. The specific instance, I believe, that Mr. Oxley was referring to was, 30 years ago, 25 years ago, and there have been books written about that process. That's, not anything about what's happening now. We have looked. Wisconsin's process is relatively similar. I mean, it's not exactly the same. Actually, some of my colleagues in another division of the commission have been meeting with staff from other regions looking at siting and routing programs. North and South Dakota certainly have different processes. I'm not intimately familiar with that. That's not of those processes. I believe they're considered somewhat less rigorous or considered less rigorous perhaps than Minnesota's process. But again, process gives people due process. Their balance, their checks and balances, if all you want to do is for the regulators to say yes to anything that's proposed, we don't need a process. So, I mean, it's always a balance to what should be. I believe Wisconsin's is similar. I believe North and South Dakota's are would be considered probably more streamlined than Minnesota's.
Okay. Senator Rosen, do you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Gonzalez, I think actually this is probably just more of a comment than a question, and I was hearing some red flags were going up when I heard your discussion about lawsuits, the permitting process, and how it should follow the statutes that are in law, but they don't because of potential lawsuits. Am I hearing that correctly?
Ms. Gonzalez.
Madam Chair, Senator, I'm sorry, I misspoke if that's what I said. What I simply meant was that there's certain due process requirements in Minnesota law that there are things that have to be done in an environmental impact statement. There are certain things that just have to be done under Chapter 14 administrative procedures. People have to be given notice. There are all these kind of things that have to be done. And I guess what I was saying is it's not that we're not following the processes due to lawsuits. I'm just saying when you have a situation where you're going to go 14 months instead of 12 months, but by going the 14 months, you've made sure that proper notice was given, that people can have had a chance to adequately participate, they've been able to look at new information and get that adequately in a record, you're more likely to not you're more likely to be in a position where the record is a good record that the commission's making decision on, and a court is not going to later reverse saying you should have given X person the time they wanted to get this new information in the record. So I'm just talking due process in general is probably needs to be given priority over absolute deadlines at times when that's going to make a good record for decision making is what I was trying to say.
Senator Rosen. Thank you, Madam Chair and Ms. Gonzalez. The permitting process is obviously a concern for many of the stakeholders here. And I think rightly so. We as legislators can be in this Capitol and make some wonderful legislation and some wonderful guidelines or standards or whatever we want to do to set the bar high. But if we cannot depend on our commissions, our agencies, our departments to live within their statutes and live within the laws that are given to them on the permitting process, and I'm not just talking the PUC, I'm talking many of the other agencies that we're dealing with on these renewables. I think it's very hard for any business to want to do business or any business to come into Minnesota to do business and set up shop and expand. And I just think we either should tighten up our regulations or hold them to a higher standard because it is not a business-friendly environment in this state for a lot of the renewable companies and people that are coming in. And I am speaking a little bit on the wind energy, and I'm also speaking very much so on the ethanol area. But we have to take a look at what we have set in law and what we should require out of these agencies and the PUC and hold them to that standard.
Do you have any comments on that, Ms. Gonzalez?
Madam Chair, I probably shouldn't. I'm just saying I certainly understand the senator's concern, and we are trying extremely hard to live within it. I would point out that and we generally do. I would say 90% of anything of all the certificates and types of things we've done are within that time frame. But things come up, it's the flexibility argument. Things come up in procedures. We have administrative law judges running these, and they're going through the type of court it is. I'm not sure what we're supposed to do, say certain people can't intervene, say certain information can't get in the record. But we are talking about fairly, it's very difficult. We are working very hard since we got the authority from the EQB in 2005. I think we've made some major progress. While certainly the Big Stone matter is going to take more than a year, we are also at the end of that going to have a certificate of need or a decision on a certificate of need and a decision on the routing, which would not have happened or would be very unlikely to have happened under the other. I really think the whole process is going to end up being much shorter than it had been under the dual agency structure. Now, I can't prove that because we can't go back to that, but I'm just saying I think overall the main permitting needed from the state is going to have been much shorter than it would have been prior to that, and we've worked very hard to make that happen.
I'm wondering if you can comment on a situation that I've heard repeated a couple of times where there are utilities, and I don't know if this has happened more than once or if it's a single incident, where utility has contracted for wind energy and the wind energy has been developed and the wind is being generated, but they can't get it onto the transmission line. So the company is paying, the utility is paying for the wind generation, but is unable to use the energy.
Madam Chair, yes, that's true. I don't think it has a whole lot to do with the state permitting process, but yes, certainly Xcel Energy has contracted for some wind energy and probably others, but Xcel's the one I'm most familiar with in the Buffalo Ridge area, that where the transmission lines that the commission approved in 2001 with a certificate of need are not fully up. Some of them are up, some of them aren't. There are what we call curtailment payments. There was a conscious decision made that because of the uncertainty about the federal production tax credit, that it was better to get some of these, the only way you could get financing, and it just made sense to get some of these projects online, even if all the transmission facilities wouldn't be there for all of them to run at peak times all the time. That's been a very controversial issue of, you know, you don't like to pay somebody to not generate. It's kind of like paying somebody not to grow corn or something, but you don't have any benefit of the field lying fallow. I mean, you don't really have any benefit from that. It's certainly not an ideal situation, but I don't think it was because the permitting took a long time. I just think it's the reality of getting construction done and the growth in wind on Buffalo Ridge that was, I certainly can't say it was unexpected, but perhaps came on sooner than some people were expecting, and also just the uncertainty on production tax credits, which might have gotten some facilities online faster than perhaps would have been the most logical otherwise.
What does that say for the future then? Is that going to be a problem for us as we move forward?
Madam Chair, I think it's possible. I mean, I think a number of people around here certainly know more about this than I do, who will probably testify that certainly hoping that the federal government will, if they're going to, will be very clear about what their production tax credit or other incentive structures are out into the future rather than doing this every year. That would help everybody immensely.
I guess my question more is, are we going to be able to meet the demand? Are we going to be able to build the transmission to be able to meet a 25 or 20% standard by a certain date?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I don't know that I can really say that. You have a lot of people here with lots of expertise on that. I think if the direction's given and the will is there, everyone will try extremely hard to do that. A lot of it depends on where the facilities are, how the planning is done. There's so many factors that I guess I don't really feel that I can say for sure one way or the other. I think that's what you're hearing from a lot of people. I don't think the permitting process per se, the need and the siting processes are going to be the main determinants of whether those facilities get built. They might be determinants of whether specific facilities get built in specific areas, and that's what the processes are for. But I don't think they're going to be the major barrier.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony. I think, is Reverend Peters here now?
He was here. Madam Chair, he was in the back of the room a minute ago. Maybe we should have somebody go find him. Maybe he doesn't.
I'm sorry, he had to leave, I guess. I would like to call on Bill Grant at this time, then. Mr. Grant, welcome.
Members, my name is Bill Grant. I'm with the Isaac Walton League. The League is a 80-year-old conservation organization, a national organization. We've been working on energy issues, among other things, in Minnesota since before the Prairie Island days. That dates me and at least a couple of the members of the committee somewhat, but I'm also here today representing Clean Energy Minnesota. We've worked closely with Senator Anderson in the development of Senate File 4, but we've also been meeting very closely with stakeholders over the last several weeks to help your bill become a delete-all bill, Madam Chair, and to hopefully meet the tight deadlines that you've laid out for the committee. I do have a handout, if the page could help
page
me.
Page will
with
help
that.
You.
Just one example, Madam Chair, of the way that we've worked with utilities over the last week or so. After our meeting last Friday with Mr. Fuller, we met with utilities and the State Chamber of Commerce and others later in the afternoon and made what I think is great progress on what we would consider appropriate off-ramp language and provisions. We've, in doing so, pulled together elements of your bill, Madam Chair, as well as Senator Tomasoni's bill into Senate File 4, and I think it'll be a better bill for it. We will continue working with all of the committee members and all of the other parties to craft an aggressive but fair renewable energy bill for Minnesota. The bill has a number of important moving parts, as I think you know, and for example, the off-ramp provisions. And I'd like to, if I could, give the committee some numerical context for some of the provisions that we're considering. As you're getting this, the first page of the handout that I've sent around really gives you a breakdown by utility of each of the three major proposals in terms of how much and how quickly we would add renewable energy in Minnesota. As you can see, we've got a 20 by 20 scenario, a 25 by 20, which is the Senate File 4 position, and then a 25 by 25 position. Underneath each of those columns, you'll see three separate columns representing various growth rate scenarios that would lead to varying amounts of renewable energy required under the bill. As committee members will remember, because this is an energy-based standard, as growth on the system occurs, as we get, for example, at a 2% growth rate, we're going to expect more renewable energy to be required because there are more kilowatt hours being sold, and that's the base over which we're calculating the amount of renewable energy. This gives a strong incentive, Madam Chair and members, to achieve a lower growth rate in order to not have to meet as high a standard on the renewable side. As you can see, the 0% growth rate is accordingly the lowest amount of renewable energy that would be required under each of the three provisions. The second handout that I have for you addresses just one of the amendments that I believe we will be seeing when you take amendments to the bill, and that is to exclude from the base that we use to calculate each of these scenarios the amount of hydro that some utilities have from the Western Area Power Administration. And you can see how this plays out very differentially for the various utilities. For some who have no WAPA allocations on their system, there would be no impact, and they would have to achieve the same level of renewables. For some of the municipal utilities, however, including their WAPA allocations reduces the amount of new renewable energy that we would otherwise require them to achieve by a rather substantial amount. This is why we have taken the position that all utilities should meet the same requirements, because once you start varying for one set of utilities, you get these very different effects in terms of how it plays out for each. And so this is really by way of an example of those impacts and just one of the amendments that I expect the committee will be considering. The last handout that I have in the packet there shows you what I think is perhaps the most important difference between the three bills, and this is the amount of carbon dioxide that we would expect to reduce with each of them. And as you can see, these are levels of reductions from the utility sector below 2005 levels by the year 2025. And so you can see that the 20 by 20 is the provision that achieves the lowest amount of CO2 reductions, net CO2 reductions, and the 25 by 20 achieves the largest with the 25 by 25 provision achieving something between those two. I think for the purposes that we're putting a renewable energy standard in place, achieving aggressive CO2 emission reductions is certainly for Clean Energy Minnesota, and I know for a number of the members of the committee, perhaps the most important consideration, and I wanted to give you some sense of how that plays out for each of the provisions. I wanted to clarify our position on the various elements of the stand or of the side-by-side that Mr. Fuller gave you. First, with respect to what counts, and for the reasons that I've just explained, believe that discounting or eliminating from the base or otherwise excluding or rather including renewable energy that are already on utility systems is not in the best interest of the state, and we would urge you to reject those kinds of measures. In terms of the size of the bill, the 25 by 20, as I've just said, achieves the highest level of CO2 reductions. We've heard testimony in this committee that those levels are achievable. I'll remind committee members, and we've heard this afternoon from Mr. Oxley and others before him, that utilities now believe that a 20 by 20 standard is something that they can accomplish. Remind you that just a year ago, in this committee and other places, those same utilities were saying that it was not possible to achieve those levels. Now, of course, they're saying that 25 by 20 is not achievable. I think there's you need to keep the history of this in mind somewhat. I think the most compelling testimony you've heard before your committee is that the wind integration study has proven that achieving those levels is aggressive yet doable. It is going to take a lot of work to get there, but it is something that we can achieve. As far as what label we apply to this, whether it's a standard or an objective, I think you've heard us say that calling this a standard sets the clearest signal to the market, both in Minnesota and outside. The objective is a less clear signal to the market, and after all, if we've all agreed that it doesn't matter what we call it, then our strong preference would be to call it a standard. As far as off-ramps are concerned, I've discussed that a little bit. We will continue to work on the off-ramp question, including the question of transmission availability. And I can assure you, Madam Chair and members, that we have every interest in bringing you back a set of amendments that accomplish this in a fair but flexible way. As far as compliance is concerned, we think that, as with calling this a standard, setting a strong compliance penalty sends a clear message to the market that we are going to accomplish this standard in Minnesota. I will remind members, though, that establishing a strong credit tracking and trading provision will always be available as an alternative compliance vehicle and will always be the least cost compliance vehicle if all of the other off-ramp provisions tell us that getting to the standards is not doable for whatever reason. Finally, with respect to tradable credits specifically, we strongly support the inclusion of stronger language, both to give the commission authority in this area. We also believe that utilities ought to be required to participate in a commission-approved credit tracking system. We don't think it works if some are in and some are out. From the commission's perspective, in terms of tracking compliance, it's going to be the best one-stop shop for determining whether all utilities are in compliance or not. For the purpose of trading credits, the best way to assure that we have a fully functioning market is to have all the market players involved. Finally, Madam Chair, if I may, just one comment on the conversation that you just wrapped up regarding transmission siting and the length of time that it takes. I believe that when you heard from the commission, when Mr. Haar or Dr. Haar was here and a couple of the commissioners, I think Dr. Haar pointed out to you that commission staffing levels in Minnesota are well below the national average, well below the regional average, probably somewhere in the bottom quartile. For me, Madam Chair, as a Minnesotan, that's not something to necessarily be proud of. I think that's something that you may want to take a look at if timelines for meeting permitting guidelines is a major concern, and I believe it is, especially with the aggressive timelines that we've put in Senate file 4. So with that, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to answer any of the committee's questions.
Mr. Fuller has a question about your third graph.
Yes.
Madam Chair, Mr. Grant, first let's check an assumption. Is it correct to say, since the standard is applied against the amount of kilowatt hours sold in any particular year, that if you had to have 25% by renewables in 25, that 25% would be a larger number than 25% of 2020? So you would generate more renewables, everything else being held constant. Yeah,
and I think if you look at the first chart, Mr. Fuller, okay, that does, in fact, get borne out.
So then,
out.
With respect true. To the third chart, wouldn't the rate of CO2 reduction increase under the 25 at 25 at a faster rate and sometime overtake the reductions at 25 or 20, or am I missing? And I could very well be missing something.
Madam Chair and Mr. Fuller, that's a question I'm going to have to answer for you after the hearing. I don't know the answer. I'll have to get back to you on that.
Do you have a guess?
I do have a guess that because we continue to have growth on utility systems and setting a higher standard earlier is going to get you a bigger bang for the buck than delaying the standard, even if you set it somewhat higher. But there probably is a crossover point, and we could play those numbers out for you beyond the 2025 if you'd like.
Thank you. Senator Jungbaugh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Grant, I'm noticing in the fine print under here that your charts assume a 40% wind capacity factor. Can you explain that to me?
Madam Chair and Senator Jungbauer, we have assumed a 40% capacity factor, and it is true that not all wind facilities, wind installations are achieving that capacity factor today. The very best sites in the Buffalo Ridge are approaching the 40% capacity factor, and we believe as technology and equipment continues to improve over the life of this standard that a 40% capacity factor is a reasonable assumption to make. One can play with the numbers and use a lower capacity factor, and that would adjust these numbers accordingly.
Senator Jung.
Madam Chair and Mr. Grant, then, so if we, your contention is if we could get transmission to the Buffalo Ridge area, that would approach that 40% wind capacity factor in that area based on our research?
Madam Chair and Senator, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions? Thank you, Mr. Grant.
Thank you.
Trudy Richter, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Trudy Richter, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Resource Recovery Association. And in your packets, you have a handout that I provided prior to this meeting today. I'm here on behalf of 9 waste energy facilities that provide waste processing services for over 33 counties in the state of Minnesota. And I'm also here representing the Solid Waste Management Coordinating Board, which represents the 6 metropolitan counties, with the exception of Scott County. And that is because those counties rely heavily on waste energy for their solid waste management. Well, you're probably wondering why in an energy committee you're going to hear something about solid waste. And that's because the legislature in 1980 passed the Solid Waste Management Act that directed counties to reduce reliance on landfills. And over the years, counties have spent over $300 million to build waste energy facilities to process waste into energy. Those counties are on the back. There's a map that shows probably facilities serving many of your constituents. Waste energy facilities are some of the most highly regulated energy facilities. We have very sophisticated air pollution control equipment, and thus we're much more expensive than landfilling waste. One of our sources of revenue for running these facilities is, of course, the tipping fee, but the other sources are revenue from our energy sales. And in 2003, the legislature recognized waste to energy as eligible energy technology because we are largely biomass. And thankfully, all of the versions of the bill you are looking at today still retains waste to energy as eligible energy technology. And thank you very much for that. But garbage is not an easy fuel to burn, and it's certainly not as easy to manage as fossil fuels. It's not homogeneous. And although it's 70 to 75% biomass, it is clean, it's reliable, and it does create a base load. Plus, it conserves natural resources. The problem is that cost per kilowatt hour, we are never going to be as low as fossil fuels nor as wind. But we're reliable and we're technically feasible. So the second point I'd like to bring to your attention, and what I need from this legislation, is a hope that the final language you adopt needs to protect biomass for meeting the renewables requirement. I was, as Mr. Fuller stated, that lone trade person stating that we needed to have a biomass set aside. Otherwise, you're effectively adopting a renewable bill that is really only a wind energy bill, because there's language in all versions of the bill that allow the PUC to not accept an energy alternative that would increase rates. And there is that possibility with using biomass, not just waste energy, but all forms of biomass, because it's a material handling problem. It's much more expensive to work with and to deal with. And so I'm trying to work with the various groups to include some form of language that will allow the PUC to recognize the importance of biomass as part of the renewable strategy and not just merely discard it because it will be more expensive. I want to thank you for your continued support, and thank you for being a part of the solid waste management answer in this state, even though you perhaps didn't realize you were sitting on this Energy Committee. Any questions?
Yeah. Ms. Richter, could you comment on how much more expensive it is, the biomass is, compared to other forms of renewable energy? And also, with so much garbage out there, why is it so expensive?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, biomass can range up to 13 cents, I'm afraid, per kilowatt. That's not what waste energy costs, but we can't feasibly get our costs down to 4 cents per kilowatt, which I understand is what wind currently is. I don't know the actual cost per facility. A lot depends on the throughput, the size of the facility. The facilities in northern Minnesota and scattered around are quite small facilities serving those regions. The larger facilities in the metropolitan area tend to have better energy sales. As it relates to why so much waste, back in 1994, the Supreme Court of the United States adopted what we call the Carbone decision, deciding that it's unconstitutional for us to control where our waste is managed. Until that time, we were able to charge enough at the gate fee and direct the waste to these facilities to burn the garbage and manage the garbage here in Minnesota. Now our waste goes many other places, and we've fought very hard to keep the facilities functioning. But we need the help of any revenues we can get off the energy side of the arrangement.
Isn't it also true, though, that you are dealing with your waste problem also? So
that's correct.
You are resolving one problem, which has a value of itself. Apart from what you would be selling the energy for.
Madam Chair, that is correct. But it is an opportunity to be another renewable source for this state.
Yes, yes. Senator Jungbar.
Madam Chair and Ms. Richter, I'd love to say that I'll fight on that issue, since if the committee is ever interested, we could take a very short field trip only up to Elk River in my district. We have a refuse-derived fuel plant, we have a landfill gas generation plant, and we have wind power located within about a mile from each
That's
other.
Correct, yeah.
So it's a very good, very short time frame, and you can see all these things. I do have a bill, too. The committee could know about that actually allows for more garbage transfer stations, which actually separate it out so we can use more garbage for refuse-derived fuel and only landfill that which you need to landfill. And you're going to see a big movement towards that on the environmental issues across the United States. I went to several different environmental conferences around the country, and landfilling is getting to be a big issue. But our cities are fighting against these transfer stations that will actually separate out the garbage so we can burn it and recycle what people won't recycle in their homes.
Okay,
so it's a big issue.
Thank you, Ms. Richter.
Thank you.
Beth Solholt.
Chair.
Oh, I'm sorry. Senator Sinjo.
I'd just like to maybe add some, not that I need to, credibility to her, to her testimony. You know, we in Rochester do burn our waste for all of Olmsted, in fact, all of Dodge County as well. It works beautifully. You know, through the use of steam turbines, of course, we sell power on the grid. But beyond that, and it's noted on the sheet here, we are able to, through steam, heat the Mayo Civic Auditorium, a fairly large building. The Olmsted County Government Center, which includes the Rochester City Hall, a number of other buildings, 26 to be precise. So, I mean, there is a it's a beautiful, I think, example of using what otherwise might be a landfill waste to some very beneficial use.
Yes, and Senator Senjum, there's nothing in the bill that prohibits the use of biomass.
Thank you.
Thanks. Beth Solholt.
Madam Chair, I have some handouts.
Paige will pick them up.
I just ate chocolate. It'll wreck the chocolate taste. Are these cheese or chocolate? Good old chocolate. Good afternoon, Madam Chair. My name is Beth Solholt. I'm with Wind on the Wires. And Wind on the Wires was launched approximately 5 years ago to work precisely on the issue that has become kind of front and center here today, transmission for renewable energy, primarily wind. The handout that I'm that is coming around right now has a background slide for you on Wind on the Wires, and I'm going to skip over that as well as the next slide that shows our footprint. What I want to start with today is some basic conclusions. I think that there have been a lot of questions about transmission, and since we've been involved in these matters, including the Southwest Minnesota Buffalo Ridge lines, the four new lines that went in Southwest Minnesota, I'd like to share some real examples with you about time frames and about how quickly some of this might be able to be constructed to meet the renewable energy standard of 25 by 2020. Let me start with the conclusion slide, the last slide. First of all, I think that the CapEx and MISO folks the other day were much too modest about the work that they have been doing. I think you heard part of their story, but you have not heard the whole story. They have been very aggressively working on a number of studies that include significant amounts of wind power. They have identified transmission, and that transmission is moving forward for approximately 2,000 megawatts of wind today. That's about a third of what we would need to meet the renewable energy standard of somewhere between 5,000 and 6,000 megawatts. It's also true that CapEx and MISO folks have been anticipating the legislature putting in place a higher renewable energy standard. And by virtue of the work that we've done with them over the last 5 years, we've really tried to push the envelope. When we started talking about renewable energy 5 years ago, it was studying 50 megawatts, and that was a large amount. A couple years later, it was 500 megawatts, and that seemed like a lot. Today, we're talking about having moved the decimal place another number, and that's at the 5,000 megawatt level. And I think MISO, as I'll walk through, has studied up to 20,000 megawatts, yes, at a very high level, but this has definitely been on their radar screen, and they have been diligently working on facilities that would be needed to serve the renewable energy standard. So I think MISO has already also been very aware of other states' renewable energy standards going up. They've been aware of growing loads. They've been aware of national global climate change that might drive the renewables market.
and all of those resources need transmission to deliver to market. And so my message here today is I acknowledge there's a lot of work to be done in the transmission planning arena to meet the renewable energy standard of 25% by 2020, but it is definitely doable. It's a hard problem to solve. We have to get going, you know, the minute after I'm done here, or I guess I would say the utilities are, they have an ongoing process to look at this. And so what I really want to emphasize is they are doing a lot of work on this and getting transmission for the types of standard that we're talking about here today are going to be achievable. So if you'll flip one page back and go to the slide that's titled Studies by Utilities That Include Significant Amounts of Wind, I'll start there. And I think there was a question about the Southwest Minnesota proceeding, which Ms. Gonzalez answered somewhat from the permitting process standpoint. But we were involved, Wind on the Wires was involved at a very technical level with the utilities on that from the day one study process. And I wanted to walk through the time frame just telling you that that proceeding involved four new transmission lines, one 92-mile, 345 kV line, a high-voltage line from Sioux Falls to Lakefield Junction, and three other lower-voltage lines of significant length, plus several dozen other upgrades and fixes that needed to be done on the transmission system. In short, this was not a small proceeding. The study started late in 1999. In 2001, the utility Xcel Energy filed their certificate of need. In March of 2003, the Public Utilities Commission issued their order for the certificates of need for the four new transmission lines. And the initial completion date for those transmission lines was 2006. But that has been pushed back to parts of them are done. Parts are going to be done in 2007, and the last little bit of it won't be done until early 2008. But this will enable almost 1,000 megawatts of energy. Again, not a small undertaking. But we walked through the process very systematically and did this proceeding for the new transmission lines and those several dozen fixes. So if we look at... if we look at kind of the bookends of what's being done out there, under the wind generation outlet, the four new transmission lines in the Buffalo Ridge area were for approximately 1,000 megawatts, 825, but MISO has the final say on how much can be put over those lines, and it could be more than 825. The second thing that Xcel is working on is a Buffalo Ridge incremental generation outlet. Those are three new 115 kV lines in the Buffalo Ridge area for 300 to 400 megawatts of outlet capacity. Then one of the studies in one of the lines in the CapEx 2020 Group 1 projects is a Southwest Minnesota to Twin Cities 345. Now that has been studied for reliability purposes, for wind generator outlet purposes, really for both. And arguably that will enable another 1,000 megawatts of wind generation from the general region. And so we're already beyond arguably beyond 2,000 megawatts with those three proceedings. And so I just want to, again, emphasize how much is going on in the area to plan and to anticipate the kinds of needs that are going to be needed to meet the renewable energy standard. The other things I want to touch on quickly, there is quite a bit of work going on for community-based energy development, looking at really utilizing spots on the transmission system that are not as constrained, looking at what we're calling on-ramps as opposed to off-ramps, but on-ramps for community projects that could be constructed, on-ramps that could be constructed more quickly. Maybe it's 115 kV, maybe it's a 69 kV, but something that could be constructed relatively quickly. So those are the kinds of things that are encompassed there. You've already heard about the Minnesota Wind Integration Study. And then I guess finally CapEx 2020. The things that they are studying are really transmission to serve load growth by between now and 2020. But I want to emphasize that they are aware that the legislature is looking at 20 or 25% standard, and they are, as we speak, in their shop, cranking away on things that could address, map out kind of a vision plan of where we need to go for looking at transmission to meet the renewable energy standard. So, again, a lot of work going on by the technical folks in the utilities to address transmission for the renewable energy standard. The other piece that I just want to touch on is the next slide, the evolution of MISO transmission planning. MISO, again, is the Midwest Independent System Operator. This, again, illustrates the kind of forward-looking transmission planning that is going on in the region for Minnesota and for the rest of the region. If we look at the first transmission expansion plan, that really had a wind development plan of 10,000 megawatts. Now, keep in mind that MISO is a 15-state and Manitoba, one Canadian province, kind of footprint, so it's a large footprint. But as we add up the renewable portfolio standards, the goals, the objectives that the states have within that 15-state footprint, we get quickly to thousands of megawatts of new renewable energy. MISO understands that, and they recognize that they need to be proactively planning for transmission to move that to load. And so they've been looking at that very aggressively since 2003. Their next plan was in 2005, and they had some exploratory studies that were pretty forward-looking, admittedly high-level studies. But again, it shows the kind of commitment and understanding to the type of transmission and the renewable energy issue that they've been looking at for really the last 4 years. And then in 2006, they looked at 10% wind energy across the MISO footprint, transmission needed to deliver that, and they looked actually at 20% for Minnesota. So, again, another very proactive, positive step to think about what kind of transmission would be needed for not only Minnesota but the region. And so that's why I guess I was a little dismayed to hear CapEx not emphasize and MISO not emphasize all the good stuff that they have been doing. Again, I think they were much too shy about all the good work they've been doing in proactively thinking about transmission for higher levels of renewable energy, and particularly for the renewable energy standard in Minnesota. One final point. I think somebody had asked about the assumptions that the CapEx Group 1 has made on megawatts, including the renewable energy obligation. They planned, Group 1, really, they did a number of studies, but they're planning, they projected that by 2020, they would need between 6,300 and 8,000 megawatts of new generation to serve load growth by 2020. That's for Minnesota overall. In the studies that they did, they assumed 2,400 megawatts of new renewables, primarily wind, which was to meet the 10% renewable energy objective by 2015. That is already taken into account in the Group 1 CapEx studies. Their Group 2 and 3 will obviously anticipate the to a much finer level of detail, the things that we need to do to achieve the 25%. But again, just an example of how really top of the mind and proactive the utilities have been in planning transmission for renewable energy. So I'm certainly willing to answer any questions, but I really want to just provide the committee members, Madam Chair, with a good snapshot of all the good work that utilities have proactively done to look at transmission needed, not only for renewables, but to serve load growth by 2020, but with a large slice of that being to deliver renewable energy to market, to load.
Thank you. Any questions? Okay, thank you for your comments, Ms. Solhold. Assistant Commissioner Mike Ball.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Mike Bull, Assistant Commissioner for Renewable Energy at the Minnesota Department of Commerce. I'm going to be pretty brief because you guys have heard enough from me. Senator Sparks, I wore my tie.
See this?
It doesn't match anything, but I wore it. Madam Chair, the process that you're going through is essentially the process that we went through in putting together we're hearing from the same folks that you were hearing, the same dynamics that you have been dealing with. How do you deal with the customer issues, the utility issues? Still put in place a very aggressive proposal that protects consumers. And after going through that analysis, that's how we ended up with our 25 by 25, very firm, very aggressive renewable energy objective. And I think you're, Madam Chair, I think you're doing an excellent process here to hear those dynamics and get those testimony before the committee so you can come up with your own package that meets those same sorts of requirements that that we're looking at. I look forward to the delete all that I understand will be coming. The one thing I think the one of the best messages you heard today, the reason we have to pass legislation this session is that we have to crush Iowa. We are just behind Iowa in terms of total megawatts, and we have to crush Iowa. Let's say it with me, everybody. that's one thing that I think we need to. We think of ourselves as national leaders in terms of renewable energy production, and our competitor states, I think, are catching up and doing a good job, and it's time for us to step up as well. The one thing that I think I need to, the one drum I need to beat on one more time, and then I'll go sit down and shut up, is the community energy piece. There's been a recent University of Minnesota study to show that that comparing a community-owned wind project with a corporately-owned wind project, you get 5 times the economic development benefits to the state and 3 times the job benefits to the state. We can't leave those opportunities on the table. We have to do what we can to capture those. Under the current bill, if it were to pass as those bills are currently proposed, we would not be able to capture those benefits. We would leave those benefits on the table. Those energy dollars, this tens of billions of dollars a year that we spend, would continue to leave the state. And that, I think, would be a missed opportunity, a mistake for Minnesota, and a missed opportunity for rural Minnesota. And I think we need to do what we can. I understand where the process before this committee, but there will be opportunities as the bills move forward through the process. I hope and pray that we'll be able to make those changes before we get the bill to the governor's desk. One thing on that, Madam Chair, is that former Representative Doug Peterson was here last week to talk about the benefits to rural Minnesota of the ethanol mandate, the E10 mandate we passed in the mid-90s. And I absolutely agree with him about that. The key component to that, Madam Chair and members, was that before we passed that ethanol mandate, we made sure that we had a number of farmer-owned cooperative ethanol plants in place already, so that when we passed the mandate, those folks were there to capture the value of serving that mandate. Without that, Madam Chair, members of the committee, the value of the mandate would, I think, have been lost to the state. And we're faced with a similar situation here. And thus far, the bill doesn't incorporate that capturing those local economic development dollars. So I wanted to leave you with those thoughts, and I'm available to answer questions, or if you've heard enough from me, I'm willing to slink back into the audience.
Thank you. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Cole, just wondering, why are we seeing competition with Colorado, and what's the difference between what Colorado's doing and Iowa's doing? As far as is it the permitting process? Is it, do they still have the market, the turbines issue to deal with? What's the difference?
It's different in the two states. Madam Chair, I'm sorry. In Colorado, they've passed a renewable standard. It was on the ballot and was passed actually by a vote of the people. So they have a standard and they're moving forward. there. It's a 10% standard, as I understand. The in Iowa, they have their primary, their big utility there, which I believe is MidAmerican, has decided that it's going to be a leader in wind energy, and it's putting its own, it's owning most of the projects, as I understand, in Iowa, and they're just going forward. They don't have a big standard down there.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Mr. Bull, so in Iowa, they don't have a big standard, but they are counting everything that's in place already. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, they are ahead of us by, you know, 30 or 40 megawatts of installed capacity. It's a very close race. We have, as we put a project online, we go ahead of them. As they put a project on, they come back ahead of us. And they have a, I think that, and I'd be willing to be corrected, but I think that under our current standard, that our projected growth is greater than their planned installations there. But still, we must crush it.
Senator Rosen.
Just to switch gears just a little bit, Mr. Bull. What, in your best guesstimation, would you say is the transmission issue problem? What are we, you know, get through all the layers, the big elephant, that whole thing. What's the big issue here?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, you know, I actually think it comes down to the fact that transmission is really hard. That transmission, that the utilities, it's primarily a reliability issue for the utilities. It's not an investment that they make a lot of money on, a lot of return on, and the process for getting a transmission line in place is painful. You know, you're talking about a lot of landowners spread out over miles and miles and miles, as opposed to a concentrated project that you deal with, you know, a few hundred, and then you're all set. So I think, in general, it boils down to a risk and reward dynamic. We passed in 2005, Senator Anderson was a chief author of a bill that we intended to take away as many of the regulatory and cost barriers as we could from transmission investment, away from the utilities, to make sure that we took out of the way, out of their way, the things that we could think of that they've told us were problems, cost recovery, regulatory process. At that time, they had to go through two separate proceedings, one at the Public Utilities Commission, one at the Environmental Quality Board, in order to get approvals. We combined those at the Public Utilities Commission, and you heard from Janet Gonzalez that they're working to combine the processes, siting and routing and need together to make that even more streamlined in a regulatory sense. So they're having difficulties. It's something that they haven't had to do for a number of years. I think you've heard, but if you haven't, I'll tell you that we've 30 years ago, we were in a building phase, building capacity, building generation, building transmission. And over the past 30 years, we've grown up into that capacity, the additional capacity that we planned for. And now we're in a new phase where we have to start building again. And a lot of this has to be relearned. How do you build a big transmission line? How do you build a big generation facility? The other thing to know, members, is that we're working on to try to change the paradigm a little bit to look at what is there may be significant opportunity in the existing infrastructure for dispersed generation. At low levels, low voltages, on the distribution level, where we've been working working with the CapEx utilities and the community energy advocates to find where are the hot spots, the places where you can add generation without a lot of cost, without a lot of additional transmission investment. Because even if we started today to build a new transmission line, it does take quite a while. And so as we do that, we want to continue to add investment in wind and other generation technology, methane digesters, solar technologies, biomass facilities, new hydro, small hydro opportunities, and we can, to see where we can do that in the existing infrastructure without the big investment, while they're planned for and put the new big pipes, which we also support, in place. Was that at all respond to your question, or do you not remember what the question was?
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Bull. I think that's it.
Thank you.
I am aware of the time, and I of the three original people that signed up, there are a couple people here that would also like to address us, but of the three original people, Deborah Bergen, Margaret Hodnick, and Larry Johnston, is there any of you that would not be able to come back on Thursday if we didn't get to you today? Okay. Ms. Hodnick, would you come forward then?
Thank you. My name is Margaret Hodnick, and I'm from Minnesota Power in Duluth, and I appeared before you last week. Thank you for an additional opportunity to talk with you about renewable energy. I have just a few comments to make, and the first one has to do with getting the job done and adding renewables. And
Ms. Hodnick, pull that middle microphone a little closer, maybe.
Thank you. My comments are going to be brief, and the first thing that I want to discuss is just overall, with any energy policy decision, whether it's renewables or anything else, we think there are three responsibilities, whether it's in legislation or regulatory proceeding, and that they include keeping the cost, the reliability, and the environmental benefit in balance, and looking at all three of those things at the same time, and not any one to the exclusion of the others. So as we look at this renewable energy legislation, that's what our concerns have to do with, because those are the three factors we keep in mind in any decision that we make about energy supply. And the handouts that we're sharing with you today, the first one that you got there on top is a diagram of the current process for renewable energy objectives. It's over on the left there in the gray box, and utility resource planning there in the middle, and then the stakeholder process that ties into resource planning. And across the top are the main considerations: environmental planning, transmission planning, conservation, technical performance, and ratepayer impacts. And we thought it would be helpful to just share this diagram with the committee so that people could see overall the big picture on energy planning in the state of Minnesota and see that renewables are a very significant component. And you can see all of the steps that utilities have to go through currently, with reports that we have to file and filings we have to make on financial commitments, construction, regulatory activity, transmission activity, and other activity that we undertake to meet the renewable energy objective at this time. So all of this is currently going on and being evaluated in commission proceedings, and that's been the practice over the last number of years. That information all feeds into the resource plan filing, where utility load needs are forecasted. We consider existing power supplies, identify resource options, and present a resource plan. And stakeholders are allowed to comment and participate in that process all the way through. And the reason we just wanted to share this diagram with you is that those who maybe don't participate in these proceedings and aren't as familiar with this kind of overview may not be aware that these processes exist to this degree, to this level of participation. And this is where the environmental impact, the reliability, and the cost all come together in decisions that are made about energy supply. And we would urge that any legislation that comes out of this committee or at any time on energy take these things into account and ensure that these processes continue, because we think they produce results for customers and ratepayers that are balanced in the end. So we would urge that that when people talk about off-ramps and reliability and cost considerations, those are addressed in proceedings like this at the commission, and we think they're very important. Minnesota Power feels that it would be a challenge to meet a 20% renewable objective. We do think we could, but it will be a challenge for us to get there. However, if these processes are upheld and we can go through these proceedings and explain our costs, explain our reliability situation, we think things will come out all right in the end, as they have under the renewable energy objective up to this point, and that's why we feel it's important for this process to continue. The 25% is a real stretch for us, and we, from a cost standpoint, from an availability standpoint, have serious concerns about whether or not we could make it. If that does get put on the books, again, a process like this would allow us to make our case for what we can or cannot do and lay out our costs and lay out our reliability considerations. And we think that's only fair for not only utilities, but customers in Minnesota, people that are going to be paying these bills. And I would like to also reiterate that in our case, I think why we are as concerned as we are is that Minnesota Power is a high baseload utility, which means we have consistent demand, as I described for you last week. And the fact is that wind energy, with all of its benefits, and even though we're adding wind energy and we plan to add more, wind energy cannot drive a 6,000-horsepower taconite grinding motor 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It simply can't do it because it's not there 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So we need baseload forms of energy. One thing that we would offer and suggest that we mentioned last week and brought more information to share with you this week with regard to that baseload energy consideration is that we would like to see language added to any bill that would allow waste heat recovery power as a qualified renewable. And we've provided two handouts to you describing waste heat recovery in a little more detail as far as what it is. And generally what waste heat recovery is it captures waste heat from an industrial process or some other source, and it heats a thermal oil. And when that oil gets heated, that in turn heats a gas like pentane, which runs a turbine. So it captures the waste heat and uses it to heat a gas that runs a turbine and produce electricity from it. And projects like this are typically 5 megawatts or 10 megawatts. They're not huge projects. But we have done a study through LHB Engineers in Duluth, Minnesota, that was just completed on the possibilities of heat recovery generation in our area. And the reason that we're particularly interested in it is because it is baseload generation, the kind that I was telling you that we largely need. Again, we are adding wind. We can use some wind, but we can't solely survive on wind. We need 24-hour-a-day energy, and this is a source of that. And we have shared language with council describing what we would like added in statute to cover this type of energy. And that was obtained from a Nevada statute where they passed a law there that would allow that kind of energy to be counted as renewable. So we would like the committee to consider adding that to a renewable energy bill because we think that we have opportunities with it, and we believe other utilities might as well. So those are my comments, Madam Chair and committee members. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Thank you. Are there questions of Ms. Hodnick?
Go ahead.
Yeah, Madam
Senator
Chair.
Sparks.
Thank you, Mrs. Hodnick. And I know last week when you spoke, you talked about Minnesota Power being kind of a unique company, that they serve a lot of larger businesses that consume a lot of electricity. And I'm just wondering, I know last week too, and maybe it's not fair to ask you, but when Mr. Wolf was here and presented his wind integration study, he talked a little bit about what the increase would be on his individual home if this was to go into effect. And I know it's kind of difficult because we don't know if we're going to pass a 20% or a 25% renewable. But do you have any idea, and I think Mr. Brandt did a nice job in his testimony earlier too, of what the effect would be on some of those businesses, those larger businesses that you produce or supply power to, if that was to go into effect, any kind of increase that they may see?
Madam Chair,
Ms.
Senator Sparks. I don't have a number for you, Senator Sparks. We're looking at that right now, and I don't have a number that I can give you, but it is something that does concern us. And one thing I do want to say about the wind integration study, we participated in it. We had our engineering staff involved, and we're involved with the results. But we think it's important for people to understand that the wind integration study only quantifies the cost of integrating wind to the system. It doesn't include the cost of the energy itself. It doesn't include the cost of these additional transmission builds that a number of you have been asking questions about. So there are other costs, and this is not a negative comment toward the study at all. It's just to be clear that that cost described in that study is dealing with integrating wind to the system. How do we dovetail wind into the transmission grid? And that cost is quantified in that study, and that was very important to get at, and it was a very good study, but it is not the total cost to supply wind. And we will be looking further at the impacts to our customers to integrate different levels of wind. We've been studying that, but I don't have any numbers for you, Senator. Sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Anderson.
Madam Chair, I was just curious about your blue sheet that talks about a 38% efficiency coal-fired power plant.
Chair, I'm sorry, and Senator Anderson.
The one in Wyoming?
This sheet, the first items that are listed are the emissions that would be offset by 1 megawatt of heat recovery generation that's installed. And I have to apologize because I got this from our engineers a couple of days ago, and I don't have it all down pat. But I think what they're describing is that typically coal-fired power plants are something like 35 to 40% efficient in the energy that they use. And so they're comparing what the emissions reductions would be with 1 megawatt of heat recovery energy compared to a coal-fired power plant at a 38% efficiency. It's just being used as a comparator there, Senator. And I can find out more information about it, but I'm not an engineer. I fully admit that.
Thank you. Any further questions? Thank you, Ms. Hodney. Deborah Bergen. She stepped out. Is Larry Johnston here?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Kind of being in the last slot's a nice position because I've heard a lot of interesting things go on today that it's going to give me a chance, I think, to summarize just a bit. There's been a lot of talk about timelines, and I think that's really at the heart of much of this. But before we get down that path, the municipal utilities, I want people to understand that we moved into this very judiciously and, in fact, committed to the concept of a standard for all the reasons people have talked about today. It's just that we want that to be done in a very judicious fashion. And I think for the record, I want to make sure that people understand that we didn't say this year we can do something, and last year it was impossible to do something. Last year what we said was we don't think that it would be a good idea to pass such a bill before we had the results of the wind integration study and before we knew what transmission issues there were. Okay, so we made some ground here. But that is why we see the off-ramps is so horribly important. The off-ramps aren't there for an ability to delay. The off-ramps are there to manage an issue or a problem and then keep us moving forward in the process. You heard from the MISO folks the other day, Claire Moeller and Ms. McCartan from CapEx, that they expressed some concerns over that timeline. And, yeah, they've done a lot of really good work. But the reason that they weren't giving themselves more credit for that work is that they're quite cautious in terms of what they can deliver. On that same Thursday that we did this, FERC granted a designation of a narrowly constrained corridor, a narrowly constrained area in Minnesota that covers SEMPA's control area, Xcel's control area, MP's, Otter Tail's, Minnesota Power's. Hopefully that's a very short-run issue because of some particular issues with some of the generation in the area, but they understand how fragile that is. You also, I think, to pick up on Senator Sharon, your point, why is it so difficult here and not difficult other places? I really appreciate Mike Bull's statement. Building transmission is hard. It's hard everywhere. Maybe it's a little bit easier in Texas because you're in one large control area, ERCOT, that you maybe have fewer things to deal with. But it's not easy to go through that process. And you heard the MISO folks talk about the fact that the 3 to 4 345 kV lines that are necessary that kind of support the assumptions of the wind integration study, those are new corridors. I mean, it's not a matter of reconductoring some things and making some small improvements. Those are going to be difficult to put in place. I think another indicator of what we currently see is the curtailments that we talked about earlier. Hopefully that's short-lived too, but I'll tell you a real interesting thing that we found out in that process. In two RFPs that we've done this year, one for 30 megawatts worth of seabed and one for, well, up to 750,000 megawatt hours annually, about 230-some megawatts, I almost want to ask a question. Does anybody have any idea how many of the bidders, the 14 that came back on the seabed or the 20-some that came back on our broader RFP, would have been willing to enter into a deal to us where we didn't have to make payments if there was a curtailment? One said that they would consider sharing with us. Another one is contemplating us. So the bottom line is, and our basic response to that was the transmission constraints and problems are not, we understand you as a developer, they're not under your control, but likewise they're not under the control of our utility either. Would you contemplate some sort of sharing arrangement on that? Well, that's something we might be able to talk about, but we don't think we can finance our projects unless you can guarantee us that. So there's some transmission issues that we want to deal with, and I think what I want to close with is that's why, you know, we're not saying don't put a standard in place. We're saying put a standard in place. But that's why the off-ramps that we talk about in the Thomasoni bill are so important to us. We just want to do it in a manner that we can make sure that if we hit that brick wall, we can make necessary adjustments and keep us moving in the direction that we need to get to that standard. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, thank you. Any questions of Mr. Johnston? Senator Sharon.
Madam Chair, on the issue of off-ramps, in earlier, I think earlier testimony, there was a discussion of the off-ramps being important in order to be able to meet the renewable energy standard, whether it's 2020 or 2025. Isn't it also true that if there are adequate off-ramps, that the standard could be set at 2520?
Madam Chair, Senator, we haven't spent as much time in the municipal community quibbling over whether or not it's 20 or 25 or what the date is as we have talking about the necessity to have other pieces with the off-ramps or other things that we think are included in the Thomasoni bill that we think will encourage us to get transmission built and get things done. I mean, it's cautious of us to suggest a 20% number. Several others have mentioned that the 20 and 25 are kind of on the same trajectory, you know, if you're talking about the difference between the five-year time period. But I think we're substantively less concerned about that than we are about the ability to be able to have the transmission in place.
Madam Chair, can I summarize what
Senator
you're saying
Sharon.
Then, that you believe that that's a quibble, that discussion about whether it's 2020, 25, or 2520 is a quibble rather than, and that the focus should be on off-ramps and particularly the off-ramp that relates to the development of transmission lines.
Madam Chair, Senator. I think quibble is kind of a tough word for the rowing the 126 municipals that Greg talked about earlier in the same direction over probably from August until a couple weeks ago. But the bottom line is the reason that we set it at 20 is because we're so terribly cautious about our ability to be able to have things necessary in place and trying to do that. So the 20% was a reflection of that caution. The off-ramps were another reflection of that caution.
Madam Chair.
Senator Sharon.
I am still not clear, at least from your organization's perspective, if, because you used the term quibble, about 2020, 2025, or 2525, that the real issue is whether or not we have adequate off-ramps, that that's the important issue. Did I understand from your organization's perspective that that is what you were saying?
Madam Chair, Senator, thank you for rephrasing the question. From the standpoint of my organization, which is Southern Minnesota Municipal Power Agency, I am not speaking on behalf of the Municipal Utilities Association. The bigger concern for us is the presence of the off-ramps and suitable ability to make sure that the conditions are right for us having it developed.
Okay. Thank you.
Any further questions? Okay, thank you. Is Ms. Bergen here?
She's coming back.
Okay, then I'm going to call on Reverend Mark Peters.
Madam Chair, members of the committee,
welcome.
I'll keep it brief. I have to get my two cents to the ECFE tonight at Gaultier. So, but I have some a few things to say about renewable electricity standard. My name is Mark Peters. I'm executive director of Lutheran Coalition for Public Policy in Minnesota. I've been doing this about 11 years. Our organization represents the six Minnesota synods of the ELCA, all six bishops. And about we relate to about 1,200 congregations, about 800,000 people. As I said last year when I was testifying on the mercury legislation, which was very proud at that pass last year, that Lutherans can be very dense in Minnesota. Global warming is a religious and a moral issue, and you know, to start off here, and that's where I'm going to speak. I'm not going to be talking megawatts here for you, but the U.S. makes up only about 4% of the world's population and contributes about 25% of the world's greenhouse gas emissions. This statistic is especially important because global warming is already having a disproportionate negative impact on those least able to do anything about it. We are called to care for all of God's children, especially the most vulnerable. And we have a unique role, I believe, as faith communities in Minnesota to restore and protect God's creation. This renewable electricity standard, something that 20 other states have adopted, presents an opportunity for Minnesota to be a leader in clean energy. And I think we can build on the progress last year regarding mercury and keep moving in the direction of cleaner, renewable energy. Lutheran congregations in Minnesota have really been stepping forward on this particular issue. They have been learning about global warming. They've been addressing the issue through very concrete actions. Let me give a few specifics. In the past 12 months, between November 2005 and November 2006, an interfaith coalition, not just Lutherans, it's much broader than that, called Congregations Caring for Creation, has co-sponsored 17 and they're called Eyewitness to Global Warming Forums, and they've been with Polar Explorer Will Steger. And you've probably been reading a little bit about this in the newspaper lately. I'm just going to give you a few numbers here. Nine of those forums were in ELCA congregations. The total attendance for those has been over 8,000 people. And right now, with Will Steger heading on another expedition, the list is growing of congregations wanting to host future ones, and they're coming from all over the state right now. Examples, for example, St. Andrew's Lutheran Church in Matamidi had 1,000 people present for their forum. 1,000 at St. Andrew Lutheran Church in Eden Prairie. At Bethel and Lutheran Church in Northfield, with a capacity there of about 350, they had people overflowing, about 460 people present. This is the interest that I am seeing at the grassroots level, and the phone is ringing off the hook in our office about this particular issue. Faith Lutheran Church in Forest Lake, you know, we talk about practicing what we preach, and you know, all those forums that were held early did talk about the renewable electricity standard. Many of those generated many postcards to elected leaders about that. Faith Lutheran Church in Forest Lake has installed geothermal heating and cooling, and they're selling electric lawnmowers to reduce the global carbon footprint for their congregation, and that's also fundraising for the installation of that. They were recently on national news for their efforts. The Minnesota Energy Challenge is another thing that many congregations are engaging in. Things like energy audits, my own congregation is doing this. We formed our own creation care team. They're doing energy audits. They're looking at ways they can save money, be good stewards of energy and of their resources. They're selling light bulbs in the narthex. They're doing Energy Star appliances. They're getting rid of the energy hogs in the congregation. They're moving to solar panels in some cases. This is moving from congregations to the homes, to the businesses, the people, different hats that people wear in those settings. They're buying wind energy through green power campaigns, the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. I would like to say, and just in conclusion, this is more than a trend. It's kind of a stampede. And we're seeing it all over the place right now, and the reason I'm here today is that the Minneapolis Area Synod of the ELCA, St. Paul Area Synod, Southeast Synod, they've all passed resolutions at their annual synod assemblies on global warming, along with our national church, urging for action towards this goal. And these strong statements represent that growing call to action. And I believe Minnesota can act responsibly and can take a leadership role in setting a requirement that a growing percentage of power generation comes from new renewable energy sources. And I thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today.
Thank you, and thank you for pointing out how our population is becoming more enlightened, too, about the need for energy conservation and reduction of greenhouse emissions.
It's you know, there are a lot of tools for congregations now that are, that are taking advantage of, and it's exciting to see.
Thank you. Any questions or comments? Okay, I see we are at the end of our time, and we will be adjourning the meeting then. Our next meeting is on Thursday. Oh, nice. We're done.